So I'm glad that we have Leon Balance as our speaker today. As you know very well, Leon made a lot of contributions to essentially all areas of modern condensed physics, including things like quantum spin liquid, magnetism, and spin orbit coupled Mach insulators, 3D topological insulators, and things like that. So, as you know also very well, Leon has this envious ability of making connection between fancy theory world and experiments. So I think that we'll probably hear about that today too. So, okay, so Leon, please go ahead. He's going to tell us about new Kagome material in alkali paradigm 3 antimony 5. Correct.
Yeah, thanks, Young Beck. I appreciate the very nice introduction. It's nice to be able to join you guys. Until recently, I was teaching during this time, so I've not really been able to enjoy this seminar series, but now I'm free. I looked a bit at the list of talks and seen that you've been seeing a lot of pretty high powered theory. This will not be that. But I'd like to tell you about some, I think, pretty exciting kind of quantum materials developments and our theoretical thoughts related to them. Let's see how I do this. Here we go. So this is on the theoretical side. This is really work being championed by my student Taka and Mengxing, who's a postdoc. But in some real sense, the hero of this story is Brendan Ortiz, who's a graduate student with Stephen Wilson, who really discovered this family of materials. And they've really been explosive discovery and a really immense amount of excitement coming out of their work. I think it's really pretty pretty beautiful set of materials and properties. So he's in Stephen Wilson's group, and I'll show you also a little bit of STM data that I collaborated weekly on trying to understand from Ilya Zelkovich at Boston College. I'll start with just an introduction to the Kagome lattice and flat bands, which is what sort of drove a lot of interest in Kagome systems electronically. And then I will tell you about some of the recent experiments on these new Kagome metal materials. What's interesting about them is that they have several electronic phase transitions, orders emerging that are quite interesting. I'll give you one possible description of that related to interactions between electrons at saddle points. It's an old idea in correlated electron systems, we're kind of reapplying it here. Then I'll focus largely on one particular electronic instability, the density wave, charge density wave order, which has been observed across the whole family of these compounds. It's quite an interesting one. Talk about different possible ways that this density wave order might arise and what the evidence is. I should say, in advance, these are, probably a lot of excitement about these materials is that they're also all superconducting, temperatures below 4 Kelvin or lower. But I won't have much to say about superconductivity, largely because I would say at this point, the experimental studies are quite controversial. Many of the conclusions contradict one another. It's really very, very early stages for that. Also, the Kagome lattice is something that has an interesting history in condensed matter physics. It's named after a particular type of Japanese bamboo wick, fishing basket with this nice pattern. The earliest I could find it emerging in condensed matter came around the 1950s in response to people trying to generalize Anzauger's solution of the 2D Ising model to different lattices. So this is an early paper in which this Kagame lattice has been nicely hand drawn. You can see the beautiful old detail. The lines are not quite perfectly straight, but traditionally, most of the interest in Kagame lattices have been in the context of spin systems because it's one of the most highly frustrated lattices for antiferromagnetism. If you put antiferromagnetically interacting spins on the Kagame lattice, if they're Ising-like, they're very highly frustrated. You can't satisfy all three antiferromagnetic bonds on a triangle. For more general spins, one classically finds a great deal of degeneracy of low energy states. This is generally thought for spin 1/2 quantum spins to be probably the best place to look to find these quantum spin liquid states that Phil Anderson proposed many, many decades ago and have since become a big target. That really applies to insulating systems, this kind of physics. And there's a kind of amusing catalog of minerals named after various mineralogists and geologists, Herbert Smithite, Volborthite, Capellasite, Barlowite, discoverers of different minerals across the world with this Kagame structure of copper ions. We're going to be talking about conductors, and so the interest will be more, we might want to start with bands. One of the nice features of the Kagame lattice, which is by now very well known, is that if you just take a tight binding band, just put one orbital on every side of the Kagame lattice and solve the and consider just nearest neighbor hopping among those sites and solve the band structure, you obtain three bands because there are three sites per unit cell. And they have this structure that the highest energy band is perfectly flat for a nearest neighbor type binding model. This is taken out of one of several papers about actually different Kagame metal materials from a couple of years ago, this image. One often points to the Kagame bands. People have been interested in this flat band. People tend to be very interested in flat bands because, you know, within a flat band, the kinetic energy is completely quenched, so effects of interactions can be amplified, become very strong. One also sees that there are Dirac points in the Kagame band. In fact, these bands here look very much like the bands in graphene, which also famously has Dirac points. I had trouble finding the first instance of this anywhere in the literature, but I did find a paper here from the, I think around 1990, so I should have put the date, where someone was trying to construct the band structure of from a tight binding description of a semi-realistic model of boron, which apparently takes the structure. Quasi-realistic model, one doesn't get a perfectly flat band, but you can still kind of see here the structure. This band is rather like the flat band, and these two are rather like the dispersing Dirac-like bands. One thing that's going to play a role in the future is that in all these cases, while the flat band tends to be kind of fragile, if you add further neighbor interactions, you spoil the flatness. These other features, the Dirac cone, and in particular, there are saddle points here. You can see these shoulders and the dispersion. These are very robust. These guys understood a little bit why this band was flat, for example. Sticking for the moment in the context of magnetism, there is at least a theoretical idea which uses the flat band in the Kagame lattice to induce a strongly correlated state. The connection is that if you consider a fully polarized state of spins on the Kagame lattice, as you would get in a high magnetic field in an antiferromagnet, and then you consider a single spin flip excitation, so you act with a spin lowering operator on one of these sites, in general, that spin flip can propagate around the lattice, and one can consider a kind of single particle wave function for this spin flip. that single particle wave function obeys a tight binding Hamiltonian, which actually has the same dispersion as a as this Kagame tight binding band, except with an opposite sign of the kinetic energy. That's just because of anti-ferromagnetic interactions. So if you flip those Kagame bands that I showed you before over in energy, then the lowest energy band for this magnon is actually perfectly flat. So what this means is a perfectly flat band, you can form localized eigenstates. So the Vanier states, which you can always form from a single band, they are actually eigenstates if all the block states have the same energy for all k. And so those Vanier states are eigenstates, and what they look like on the Kagame lattice are wave functions that are just confined to a hexagon like this. So the ferromagnetic state on the Kagame has these localized magnon excitations. That means that two of these magnons, if they're more than one lattice spacing away, they don't interact. So you can put a magnon here and a magnon here with zero interaction energy between these magnons. As a consequence, when the magnetization is reduced from saturation, so here's a plot from a paper from 2002 where this was discovered, if you lower the magnetic field from saturation, the magnetization jumps from full polarization here down to a plateau that's shown here in the inset, and this plateau actually corresponds to a crystal of these magnons at a certain density. So this is an example of a kind of strongly correlated state of quantum particles that could result from a flat band. In this case, they're bosonic magnons. The idea has been around for a long time that flat bands in the Kagame lattice might lead to interesting physics in electronic systems. And in the past few years, the activity searching for Kagame metals, conducting systems, which might have the flat band features of the Kagame, has really intensified. There are quite a number of different materials here that people have studied in recent years. Here's one of the more recent ones that's been more successful coming out of MIT. This is a simple binary compound, cobalt tin, which has a Kagame lattice of cobalts. It's rather quasi-two-dimensional. And you can see that indeed there are some very narrow bands here, that could be considered somewhat like the flat band in the ideal Kagame lattice type binding model. Of course, you'll notice there are a hell of a lot more bands here than in the Kagame lattice type binding model, and that's because these are d-electron systems, so there are a lot of d-orbitals available to form bands. It's not a simple single orbital type binding model. So the application directly of these simplistic models single orbital on the Kagame lattice is somewhat questionable. But still, these guys were able to actually observe in ARPIS what seems to be a fairly flat band, relatively close to the Fermi energy. And so observations like that have been occurring over the past couple of years. At this point, it's unclear to me what the further implications of those are in those systems, but they're certainly interesting to explore. And now I want to turn to these new materials, which has started what I'd like to call kind of a analogous to a gold rush, a vanadium rush. These new papers on really started in 2019. This paper in Physical Review Materials is really announcing the discovery of these compounds and explained their basic properties and how to synthesize them. And it's been taken up by a number of groups, including Stephen Wilson's here. This has become extremely active. I have to say, I kind of prepared this talk in somewhat of a rush, having rushed out our paper on this a week or so ago, at the point where I was noticing two or three papers appearing on this subject, theoretically and experimentally, more or less every day. So I've probably undercounted, but it's very, very active. So the structure of these materials, you can kind of see here, they're two-dimensional layered compounds with hexagonal symmetry. The Kagame lattice, as advertised, is a Kagame lattice of vanadium ions, okay? And in between the Kagame lattice of vanadiums, there are honeycomb lattices of antimony. So here's what some of these crystals of the material look like. You can see they're platelet-like, which is kind of expected for their quasi-two-dimensional nature. This compound has perfect hexagonal symmetry. This is the space group. It's a rather high symmetry space group. If you want to think, theorists often like to think in terms of some kind of Hubbard model or something, and you'd be tempted to think this might be very simple. Those of you who have experience with vanadium compounds know that materials like V2O3 or VO2 are kind of poster child materials for Mott transitions, in which there are not a lot of electrons around. So nominally, one could try to do valence counting. Potassium should have one positive charge. Antimony should have three negative charges. It adds up to 14 positive charges for three vanadiums, which corresponds to an average of 1/3 of a d electron per vanadium, or one d electron per Kagame unit cell. At this naive kind of ionic picture, you would indeed think this is very simple, kind of low density electron system. We might be able to have a very simple Hubbard model like understanding. That's not going to really be borne out. And basically, the ionic picture is not very relevant, at least for the antimony. I think that spoils everything. One can say these are very different from the other metallic Kagames that have been studied before, which involve a lot more d electrons. These are all involving iron, manganese, cobalt atoms, which have a very strong tendency to form local magnetic moments involving partially filled d shells. That's really not the case here. So what are the basic properties of this vanadium Kagames? They're metallic. They have pretty low resistivity. You can see the resistivity here goes down to a few micro-ohm centimeters. So this is quite a good metal. They're very two-dimensional. Here, the anisotropy of resistivity between for currents perpendicular to layers and within the layers was measured to be about 600. So they're quite two-dimensional. Above about 100 Kelvin, they display roughly constant Pauli paramagnetism. So this is a strong indication there are no local moments here. It's just behaving like a metal with a constant magnetic susceptibility. If you look closer, you can see there are some very interesting electronic phase transitions. So this is the cesium compound, but in fact, this is seen in all three of the materials. I don't know if I said the materials exist with A can be cesium, potassium, or rubidium. So all three have been made and behave quite similarly. So there's a phase transition here at 94 Kelvin where you can see a cusp in the resistivity, a specific heat peak, and a cusp in the susceptibility. This has been shown from X-ray scattering to correspond to a charge density wave transition. There's actually a quadrupling of the unit cell within the 2D Kagame plane. And so you can see the appearance of half reciprocal lattice peaks in X-ray diffraction. And this is common to all three materials. And as I mentioned, down below, somewhere below 3.5 Kelvin, it really depends quite a bit on material and maybe also on sample, all the materials become superconducting. And not so much is at least agreed upon about the superconducting state now. This charge density wave is also visible in STM. So because it's visible in X-ray scattering, we know it's not just a surface phenomena, but from the STM, you can see that this is actually, it's not a one-dimensional charge density wave. It's really a fully two-dimensional, isotropic, at least approximately hexagonal charge density wave seems to approximately maintain the threefold rotational symmetry. Rather, it doubles the unit cell in the two principal directions. So in terms of wave vector, this is what would be called a 3Q charge density wave. It has three Fourier components of approximately equal amplitude. We'll get into that. So coming back to the question of the band structure, this has been studied both in density functional theory and measured in photo emission. So here the bottom are DFT plots and the top are photo emission. So the white hexagon here is a Brillouin zone. And what you can see within our Fermi surfaces or constant energy contours measured at different energies, this is really the Fermi surface. And you can see that the Fermi surface has this kind of intriguing shape. This is what really got me interested in these materials. You notice that it's a little complex. So there are several components. You would say there's something like a circle here, a very circular Fermi surface around the gamma point. And the most interesting one is something that looks, you know, roughly like a hexagon inscribed inside the hexagonal Brillouin zone. So this hexagon inside the Brillouin zone has this nice property that it's touching or at least close to touching the zone boundaries right in the center of the zone faces. This is a very characteristic and interesting thing that's been studied in a number of other contexts, and we'll be talking a lot about it. But first of all, you can see clearly, you know, this is very far from the ionic picture where we'd only have a third of an electron per vanadium. There's a lot of Fermi surfaces, several bands involved. And indeed, you know, this is what bands look like in a typical density functional theory calculation. There are several bands crossing the Fermi energy. One can see, if you look closer, kind of this region right here, this is around the gamma point, or here, maybe this is nice from gamma to M. This crossing here corresponds to the circular pocket in the middle. And then the other features are all kind of hidden here. You might want to look also at these curves, these right-hand panels here. These show the dispersion in the Z direction, which you can see is indeed quite narrow, so consistent with very two-dimensional behavior. So let me zoom in on the first panel here. This is showing the experimental Fermi surface at the Fermi energy. And again, I'm emphasizing that there's this very interesting, rather hexagonal looking Fermi surface, which has corners that come together at the zone centers. These are called the endpoints of the Brillouin zone. So these endpoints are actually saddle points. They're points at which a topological transition would be located in the Fermi surface. If we were to vary the chemical potential, make it a little smaller, the Fermi surface would shrink and come inside the zone. If we increase it, it has to go through the zone corner and will actually change its topology, going from electron-like to hole-like. So this corresponds actually to these kind of points in the Kagame lattice. And you notice, so this is a type binding dispersion I showed you before for the single orbital on the Kagame lattice. And you can see, indeed, there are saddle points at these M points in the zone. It's very common in hexagonal systems. Here's a dispersion for the triangular lattice, single orbital type binding model. Again, there's a saddle point at the M point. Here's a dispersion for graphene. And again, there are saddle points at the endpoints. So it's a kind of amusing to ask, you know, why are there saddle points at the endpoints? Why is this very common? Because of course, these are all cartoons. Is there any reason why this should be expected more generally? Well, in fact, there is. It's not a rigorous argument, but pretty good one. First of all, in a hexagonal system, you can show that certain points in the zone should always be critical points. So critical point is a point where the gradient of the energy vanishes in all directions in momentum space. So such a point has to either be a maximum, a minimum, or a saddle. So in two dimensions, this is required actually at gamma, at K, and at M just by rotational symmetry. The endpoint, it's not really rotational symmetry, sorry. At gamma and K, it's rotational symmetry. At the endpoint, it's related to two reflection symmetries. But that's sufficient to force the gradients to vanish. So we know that actually gamma, K, and M should always be critical points. Now, if we additionally suppose we can define a band, the whole function epsilon of K, that's smooth. This is, of course, not generally the case, but suppose it is. Then there's a very nice argument based on what's called Morse theory, which describes the critical points of smooth functions. And Morse theory tells us that if you take a two-dimensional function on a closed manifold, the number of maxima minus the number of saddle points plus the number of minima have to equal the Euler characteristic of the manifold. For a torus, that's zero. And so we know that the number of maxima minus the number of saddle points plus the number of minima must be zero. Moreover, these high symmetry points have a certain multiplicity. So the gamma point is unique. The k point is twofold degenerate because there's a k point and minus k point. And the m point is threefold degenerate because there are three inequivalent m points by rotation. So somehow we have to get the numbers 1, 2, and 3 if we assume there are no additional critical points to add up to zero following this rule that we add 2 and subtract 1. So you can see the only way to actually do it is for the maxima and minima to be at k and gamma. They could be one way or the other, but the saddles have to be at m. So this gives a kind of general argument why endpoint saddles occur. So saddle points are interesting. In two dimensions, saddle points are locations of divergent Van Hove singularities. So this is something that was studied very, very intensively in the context of the two-dimensional Hubbard model on the square lattice. I like to go back to this old paper of Jorge Hirsch and Doug Scalapino from the 80s. Here they've plotted the density of states of a single band type binding model. It has in particular this peak here, which corresponds to the Van Hove singularity of that model. That Van Hove singularity is exactly the point at which the Fermi surface touches the midpoints of the zone boundaries, what we would call the M points on a square lattice. At that point, the Fermi surface would look something like this. You can see it has a cusp. It's non-analytic at that point. They showed that this gives rise to extra logarithmic divergences in various susceptibility, and in particular, the pair susceptibility as this kind of standard Lindhardt-like form. If you look at the pair susceptibility at zero momentum, what one finds is that because of the saddle point, it has a logarithm squared singularity of temperature. For a generic inversion and time reversal symmetric Fermi surface, one gets a logarithmic singularity. That's the Cooper divergence. But for this saddle point, you get actually a stronger divergence. Basically, the Cooper divergence is supplemented by a divergence in the density of states. It's possible that that could enhance superconductivity, and there's been a lot of work in that direction over many decades. But we know very well that the two-dimensional Hubbard model, for example, at half filling is not a superconductor, but it's an antiferromagnet. And yet it also, its Fermi surface also has such Van Hove singularity. These Van Hove singularities, these saddle points, can promote not just superconductivity, but other types of electronic instabilities. And over the years, there was a lot of theoretical work trying to study the competition of these different instabilities. This goes back to work of Heinz Schultz shortly after Doug and Jorge's work. And there's one of the first papers to get kind of close to a modern formulation of the scaling theory of these saddle points is a nice paper by Didier Poiblon, Pascal Lederer, and Gilles Montembeau, who pointed out that there were four different types of scattering processes that can occur, ways that electrons can interact between these different saddle points on the square lattice. This has been kind of returned to again and again and again. I just show you one of the versions of this done by Morris Rice and collaborators in the 90s who studied this again. This form of the renormalization group treatment studies these four channels on the square lattice in a form that would agree with modern formulations. There were some mistakes in some of the earlier papers. Everything was cleaned up eventually later. And we're going to use this kind of idea for these hexagonal systems. So of course, it's not new to consider these possible instabilities in hexagonal systems. There's a number of interesting works that are relevant. Back in 2008, Ivor Martin and Christian Battista thought about how these saddle point interactions could give rise to spin density waves. My interest in this problem connected back to this work by Raoul Nandishkor, Leonid Levitov, and Andrei Chubakov, which got a lot of notoriety, where they proposed a possibility of stabilizing topological D-wave superconductivity in heavily doped graphene. As you saw, graphene honeycomb lattice also has Van Hove singularities like this. And they basically generalized the RG treatment of Morris Rice and company to this case of saddle points on the with hexagonal symmetry. There's even been work applying similar ideas to the Kagame lattice, basically inspired by Andre and company's work on the honeycomb lattice. This is a kind of functional renormalization group study of a Hubbard model, again, single orbital Hubbard model on the Kagame lattice, which finds a number of different orderings. You can see here S-wave and D-wave superconductivity and something they call charge bond ordering, which actually is very close to the CDW seen in these Kagame materials. So just to give you an idea of how this works, in the hexagonal system, there are three of these saddle points. So these are the three endpoints that sit at the faces of the zone. You can think about these as valleys. In a low energy description, we can consider electrons from each of these valleys and describe them by an index A, which could run from 1 to 3. And we can have scattering processes that describe interactions of electrons between these different patches. Electrons could just interact between two patches, or they could actually be transferred from one patch to another, subject to the constraints of symmetry. Before we think about the dynamics of these electrons, though, we can think about just what type of electronic instabilities we might describe in this way. So it's natural to construct order parameters from the electrons at these different patches, and we can consider both particle-hole and particle-particle operators. Particle-hole operators, in general, they can have both a valley index, so describing which saddle point they're on, and spin indices. So out of these, we can make spin singlets, kind of charge operators, or spin operators, spin triplets. Similarly, we can form pair fields either within or between different patches. Okay. The ones which will actually arise and be relevant are encouraged by interactions between these saddles. We sort of tabulated here. There are a few different ones, so we can have, we'll kind of refer to these, I'll just sketch them kind of quickly now. We can have a charge density wave correlation, so in which these are particle hole operators in which the two spin indices are paired in a singlet form, so sigma prime equals sigma, but we transfer electrons from one valley to another. So that means they violate momentum conservation, and this, this is an important fact. So the difference of momentum between two of these valleys, you can think about them as these vectors Q1, Q2, and Q3. These are equivalent, vector Q1 here is equivalent to this green vector here, up to a reciprocal lattice vector, because the two points on opposite sides of the Brillouin zone are identified. They're really the same. And then you notice this green vector here is actually the same as the endpoint vector. So this is a kind of amusing feature of these endpoints on the hexagonal lattice, is that the difference between two endpoint vectors is also an endpoint vector. So these endpoint vectors not only describe the momenta of the electrons, they also describe the momenta of the order parameters. So these operators, when A is not equal to B, describe, and the sigmas are the same, describe charge density waves at wave vector Q. We can consider this expectation value to be either real or imaginary. If it's imaginary, this has been dubbed an imaginary charge density wave, okay? And the real one's described a real charge density wave. We'll see that this is kind of not a very good name, but we kept it because it was used previously in the literature. One can also take these particle hole operators to be triplets. You can put a Pauli matrix in between them, and these describe similarly real or imaginary spin density waves. And finally, the superconducting order parameters that arise are all zero momentum, so not pair density wave orders that seem to arise. So these require the pairing to be between the same patch. But there can be different relative phases between electrons on the 1, 2, and 3 patches. And that allows to form different pairing symmetries. In particular, you can form S and D wave rather straightforwardly. So within this low energy approach, considering electron scattering between these saddle points, there are four scattering processes. You can kind of draw them like this. There's a G1 here is just is an intervalley exchange. So you can think about this as corresponds to interaction between the spins of one valley and another valley. There's an intervalley density. So this is rather simple, just the density of electrons in one valley interacts with the density in another. You can have an Oomklop scattering. This will play a special role, which you actually transfer two electrons from one valley to another. So it's not permitted to transfer a single electron from one valley to another. That would violate momentum conservation. But because the momentum difference between two valleys is an endpoint, it's half a reciprocal lattice vector. If you transfer two electrons, that's actually allowed. And finally, we can have just intra-valley interactions, just some repulsion between electrons at a single valley. So this there's a pretty well-defined procedure to study how these interactions fluctuations of these interactions renormalize themselves as a function of energy on reducing energy towards the location of the saddle point. And the one, because of this log squared divergence, it's best to write these RG equations as a function of the kind of log squared of the energy. Sorry, I'm blocking some of this with pictures of you, so just slide you off to the side somehow. So these are not too complicated, but a little hard to digest immediately. There are a couple of features, though, to note. One is that the sign of G1 and G3 are preserved by these equations. You can see that the beta function here for G1 vanishes if I take G1 equal to 0, and the same is for G3. And this is really due to symmetry. What it means, though, is that whatever the initial value of G1 is, which is determined by some microscopic physics that determines these interactions, it doesn't change under RG. And in particular, that has sort of given to us from the microscopics, it determines some of the physics. So if G1 is positive, it favors singlet or charge type of order, whereas if G1 is negative, it favors triplet or spin type of order. If G3 is positive, G3 is Oomklop. Oomklop is the only thing that differentiates between real and imaginary density waves. So generally, G3 positive favors an imaginary density wave, while G3 negative favors a real density wave. So one can analyze these RG equations. Generally, they describe instabilities. For a sort of generic initial condition, these couplings will actually flow off to strong coupling. They do so along some they tend to converge to some special trajectories in parameter space, and these trajectories kind of describe different types of pathways of instabilities. For me, this brings back very old memories. I kind of worked on things related to this in one-dimensional Hubbard models back in the 90s when I was a postdoc.
Can I ask you some clarification question?
Sure.
So in this analysis, are you assuming that there's just a single band from vanadium, or what's the assumption?
So the assumption is that we only keep, we're working to log squared accuracy. Mm-hmm. Okay. So within log squared accuracy, other bands can't contribute. Only the Van't Hoff singularity can give rise to his contribution. That's really the assumption.
So you just need some patch around the
kind
of singularity. Yeah. Okay.
So, that's the appeal of this approach.
Okay.
It's relatively independent of a lot of microscopic details, provided you know, things are actually dominated by the saddle points.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm probably spending too much time on this. Let me kind of get moving. So what one finds in this way, analyzing these RG equations, is that there are kind of four different instability pathways. And in each of them, certain types of orders are actually favored. In the work by Andrei Chubukov and collaborators, they focused on this one, which is the one that dominates if all the bare couplings are repulsive. And they found that the dominant instability is actually to D-wave superconductivity and a secondary instability to a real spin density wave. But in fact, if some of the other couplings, some of the couplings can change sign, which might occur for various reasons. For example, we think the most natural one is due to electron phonon coupling. There are these different other pathways that can occur. And in particular, some of the most interesting are over here. These give rise to different types of density wave order rather than spin or superconducting order. So I want to spend a little bit of time about the rest of the talk is largely going to be talking about these density wave orders, and I see I'm really wasted time. So as I mentioned, experiments pretty clearly establish charge density wave order. So there's this kind of four sublattice modulation, 2x2 modulation of the charge density seen in both X-rays and STM studies on the surface of these materials, which in this order parameter description is exactly the order described by this real charge density wave order parameter. So the question I want to ask is whether this means the primary instability describing the phase transition at this 90 Kelvin-ish transition is really a real charge density wave, or could it be due to some other types of density wave orders, which also break translation symmetry? So first, let's try to look at this. We'll carry out various symmetry analyses aided by explicit calculation of the Landau theory from this microscopic model. So first, we can introduce this real charge density wave order parameter. It looks something like this. And there's the component at wave vector Q1 is determined by the charge density wave order parameter between valleys 2 and 3 and permutations of this. This type of charge density wave pattern would be described by a configuration in which N1, N2, and N3 are all non-zero and equal in magnitude. If you take into account all the space group symmetries of the crystal, you find that the free energy as a function of this order parameter N1, N2, and N3 has the symmetries that would correspond to the tetrahedral group TD. So this is basically cyclic permutations of these Ns. As a consequence of this, one can show that the free energy takes this form, and in particular, it allows a cubic term which combines N1, N2, and N3. So you can kind of see that this is allowed because if you look at these wave vectors here, the sum of Q1 plus Q2 plus Q3 is zero. Momentum conservation allows this term, and you can see that rotations basically cyclically permute these ends, and this is allowed. So generically, the presence of a cubic term in Landau theory, at small values of the order parameter, so near a phase transition, this is going to dominate over higher order quartic terms, and we can expect it to favor configurations which minimize this term, which will have all three components of n non-zero. So generically, it's possible to study this, and near the phase transition, what typically find, so this is actually a numerical study of the full fermionic mean field theory, what you typically find looks like this as a function of chemical potential and temperature. Almost all of the region of the ordered phase of this charge density wave is this 3Q phase. There are basically two regions. the positive and negative regions correspond to the configuration in which this product has a positive or negative sign. So it turns out that K2 is basically determined by some particle hole symmetry breaking perturbation. And in between, there's a narrow region in which you could have a 1Q phase, which vanishes as you approach TC. So it's extremely natural and even expected that if this charge density wave order occurs, it occurs in the form of a 3Q charge density wave. One can try to deduce the actual charge ordering patterns like you would see in STM from symmetry and the order parameters. You actually need a little bit of extra information to do that because we need to know really how the orbitals of the vanadium are related to these bands. So from that, we have to add some EREP content from the band structure to know the EREPs of the saddle point states at the M values. And based on that, we arrive at these kind of charge ordering patterns. These are sometimes called a Star of David pattern and a hexagonal or trihexagonal charge density wave. Okay. So this is kind of the obvious thing. The experiments measure this 3Q charge density wave, and indeed it comes out very naturally as a candidate order. But there are some other orders that are certainly more interesting. In particular, another possibility that emerges from the RG is this imaginary charge density wave order. And so it's this imaginary one is exactly that. We have, again, this particle hole operator at different saddles, but it has an imaginary expectation value. So this I means that this is actually time reversal odd. And as a consequence, this breaks time reversal. So theorists like this odd order parameter and is actually was also proposed to exist in this experiment paper by Zahida. So this name of imaginary charge density wave is sort of unfortunate because, you know, this I means that what it physically represents is not a charge density modulation at all, but actually an electronic current. So what these really represent, if you again go back and do the EREP analysis on the lattice, is that they represent spontaneous currents flowing on bonds of the Kagame structure. And in particular, the 3Q charge density wave corresponds to circulating currents that circulate in different directions on certain hexagons of the Kagame lattice. Moreover, the 3Q imaginary charge density wave, so there's no obvious charge oscillation in this pattern, although you can see that this hexagon is different from these three. So there's some differences in the sites here. Probably the most important feature is this 3Q charge density wave fully macroscopically breaks time reversal. So you can form the product of phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3. Which again is translationally invariant and actually transforms identically to to an orbital magnetization in the z direction. So could this imaginary charge density wave exist and be maybe masquerading as a real charge density wave? This is conceptually possible if you write down the Landau theory that would describe the coupling of the real charge density wave n and the imaginary charge density wave phi, there are these terms here that are quadratic in phi because of time reversal symmetry, but linear in n. And these imply that a 3Q imaginary charge density wave will induce a 3Q real charge density wave. So it is indeed conceivable that this imaginary charge density wave order could be hidden behind the real charge density wave one. And theorists are not stupid. They like this odd charge density wave because, partly because it's just more interesting theoretically, but there were some kind of tantalizing experimental evidences that suggest maybe there's some exotic time reversal symmetry breaking going on. In particular, this study was carried out pretty early by Stuart Parkin and company. On the potassium compound, and they observed a very large anomalous Hall effect setting in at temperatures somewhat below the charge density wave transition. At the time they attributed it to magnetic order, they weren't aware that these materials don't magnetically order. But since then, a similar effect's been observed in the cesium compound, and indeed it seems to set in relatively soon below TC. It's actually true that if you take the perfectly nested ideal hexagonal Fermi surface and you include the effect of the imaginary charge density wave, this actually fully gaps the Fermi surface and forms a churn band. There's a very intense concentration of Berry curvature near the former saddle points that form avoided crossings between the new bands. And you can check, for example, you can calculate using this Hamiltonian we did in our little paper, the orbital length for electrons. And you can see that in this 3Q charge density wave state where all the phis have equal magnitude, there's an order one orbital moment for electrons that are within an energy of the charge density wave gap of the endpoints. So this would be very exciting, a very interesting possibility in these materials. There was also some evidence, claimed evidence for time reversal symmetry breaking in STM. So this is an experimental paper from Zahid Hassan's group, where they noticed that the intensities, so what they do is they do the Fourier transform peaks of the STM spectra in real space. One finds peaks at these endpoint wave vectors, as you'd expect in this modulated state, and they notice that the sides of these peaks are not equal. In particular, they claim that in general, the sides of the peaks are all unequal, and consequently, you can kind of define a chirality, a direction to go around the circle in which you always go from smallest to largest peaks. And that this chirality is spontaneous and even tuned by an applied magnetic field. That seems very remarkable. A few comments. First is the chirality in this sense, just different magnitudes of these peaks. This is not related to time reversal a priori. Time reversal just relates, all these momenta are time reversal invariant. There's no relation of different peaks by time reversal. If I look at the peak heights, to my eye, they look approximately twofold symmetric. There are always two high peaks and one small peak, rather different from a sort of generic three different values. But if it's true that there's actually a change in these charge ordered peaks achieved by fields that are of order only two Tesla, this would be something very remarkable and might indeed point to some very interesting topological state. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip the discussion of the spin density wave. Basically, there's no indication of spin density waves in these systems, although this was thought to be the dominant density wave instability for repulsive interactions. So the upshot of this type of symmetry argument is pretty simple. Basically, it is the case that the observed charge density wave could be either a primary order or induced by imaginary charge density wave or a real spin density wave. So how could we tell the difference? Well, the obvious one is that the latter two more exotic orders all break time reversal symmetry. So consequently, they should give rise to local either orbital or spin moments. Those could be measured, for example, by an USR or neutron scattering. The 3Q imaginary charge density wave state should actually have macroscopic time reversal symmetry breaking, so it should have a uniform magnetization, various other macroscopic time reversal symmetry breaking signatures. It would be nice to see those directly. This can be perhaps a little difficult. As far as I know, that has not been seen, but perhaps one shouldn't be too skeptical on that regard, because maybe just the moments are very small. So what I want to describe for the rest of this talk, Young-Beck, how much time can I have? Can I have 5 or 10 minutes more? Or am I?
Yeah, we started a bit late, so yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'd like to talk about how one can actually differentiate between these somewhat based on things we already know, which is really related to 3D effects. So let's first ask theoretically, how should we expect this these different density waves to be modified by three-dimensional coupling. So we're just going to make a very simple assumption that the coupling in the third direction is weak. And of course that it's local, so it decays pretty fast as we look at far apart layers. So then we can just expand the free energy in powers of the order parameter with terms that decay as we move further away to further apart layers. So here I introduce Z is just counting layers, and delta is the distance between two layers. So delta equals one and nearest neighbor layers, two is too far apart. So we'd expect that these couplings K between the real charge density wave, L between imaginary charge density wave, and J between spin density wave would decay with increasing separation. If these are weak perturbations, we can study their effect pretty simply. So first, let's look at these two. So these are the couplings between these possible hidden orders. It's possible we could have hidden imaginary charge density wave or hidden spin density wave order behind the charge density wave. It's pretty clear what they favor. Again, if the first term is dominant, which is what we'd expect, so the coupling between nearest neighbor layers, looking at this term, it'll either favor neighboring layers to have phi z equal phi z plus one or phi z equal minus phi z plus one if L here is positive. And both of those two cases are perfectly allowed. And the reason is if phi A is a solution for one layer, minus phi A is always another solution because it's just related by time reversal symmetry. So the same is true for spin. This term either favors spins to be parallel or anti-parallel in two neighboring layers. So because of this, what we expect is these primary order parameters, either the imaginary charge density wave or the real spin density wave, ought to order at a momenta in the z direction, which is either zero or pi, either in lattice coordinates, either zero or a half. But now remember that the induced order, for example, order induced by spin on charge will always be quadratic in the spin. That's because charge is time reversal invariant, so the charge order parameter should be quadratic in the spin. And the same was true for imaginary charge density wave. So the induced charge density wave order will vary like the square of the primary time reversal odd order. And therefore, this minus sign will actually go away when looking at the charge density wave. So in all these cases, what we expect is that the charge density wave should actually be the same in every layer. It should have Kz equals zero. Now, the situation is pretty different for primary charge density wave order. If this is the dominant term, just as before, if K here is negative, then we want the charge density wave to be the same in all layers, so that's fine. But if K is positive, we want it to be opposite in the two layers. But in general, this is not a symmetry of the single layer free energy. There's no symmetry that turns a charge to minus charge. Remember, the free energy for the charge density wave has this cubic term. If we change the sign of all the n's, this term in the free energy changes, and so the energy becomes bad. The best we can do when this is weak is we want to choose these NAs in one layer and NAs in another layer to be always one of these ground states. And the best we can do actually is to make the ground state change. That is, if, for example, in the first layer, NA here is 1, 1, 1, then in the second layer, we want minus 1, minus 1, 1, or minus 1, 1, minus 1, or 0, minus 1, minus 1. So this has a very simple physical interpretation. Remember, the charge density wave order looks like this. It corresponds to a quadrupled unit cell. There's some sort of, if you like, strong hexagon. When we move from one layer to the next, this interaction just prefers this hexagon to move. So in the next layer, we'd like the strong hexagon to either be here, or here, or here. That is, it can choose one of the other three choices within this quadrupled unit cell. And in doing so, we're guaranteed to not have an identical configuration in each layer. This actually still leaves some degeneracy. It's a little more complicated to analyze the full system, but it's a rather nice little bit of mathematics. If you consider the four charge density wave ground states within a single layer, so you can describe these four states by a what's called a pot spin, a variable that just takes four values, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And if you make this assumption and you plug it into this free energy, what you find is the free energy can be written like this. It's just involves a delta function interaction of the pot spins in neighboring layers. So this is actually just the energy of a one-dimensional POTS model with, in this case, antiferromagnetic interactions. So if you take into account further neighbor interactions, this 1D POTS chain is a rather well-studied but quite complicated model. It can have very complex and even aperiodic ground states. But if we make this simple assumption that these interactions decay as we go further to between further apart spins corresponding to further apart layers, it's actually not that hard to analyze. And you can show that generally the ground states either have k's equals zero, that corresponded to the ferromagnetic sign of the first k, or we have a wave vector a half, a third, or a quarter. Those are the only ones that can occur. So there's a very definite prediction of the types of 3D ordered structures that should occur if we had this underlying primary imaginary charge density wave or real spin density wave order. So primary time reversal breaking order, we should see kz equals zero charge density wave order. And in fact, the kz has been studied in a number of papers in the last 6 months or so, and it's known that for all three compounds, a kz is never zero. It's either a half or a quarter, depending on the material. And so recall, these are all consistent values that we found from this POTS model analysis and inconsistent with the time reversal breaking orders. So this is pretty strong evidence that the charge density wave is not at least primarily time reversal breaking. What about this chiral charge order that Zahid Hassan's group proposed? Well, since we could understand this KZ ordering from thinking about three dimensions, maybe it gives some insight into the charge, the chirality of the charge order. But if you go back to this picture, you think about three dimensionality is described by just translating this charge density wave pattern in one of three directions as I go from the top layer to the next layer. Just by making this choice, I single out, in this case, so imagine that the layer below has a charge density wave pattern shifted in this x direction. Just the presence of the underlying layer breaks the symmetry, threefold symmetry of the top layer. And in particular, this axis along the translation becomes inequivalent to the other two threefold axes. And one can readily show, just using the free energy I showed you before, that we'd expect the charge density peaks in the top layer to generically split into two inequivalent values, a set with two equal peaks and one unequal peak. And again, if you look at the data, this is pretty much what is actually seen. Very recently, Ilya Zelkovich's group did a more detailed study also on this. And as a function of bias, actually, these peak heights change quite a bit, but they always show this pattern of two identical peaks and one different peak, depending on the bias. So we think this is extremely likely to be related to the three-dimensional coupling. In fact, in that case, I was talking about charge density wave order at the surface, but you can also ask about the bulk. That depends a bit on detail of how this stacking occurs. You can imagine one thing I could do is as I go from the top layer down, I shift to the left. And then if I go to the next layer, I shift back to the right. So that'll be describing a k's equals a half. We have a periodicity of two. And clearly I've singled out this x direction. That's a macroscopically rotation symmetry breaking state. It turns out the only way not to macroscopically break rotation symmetry is to form a screw axis. If on the first step down, I go to the left, the next step I go, I would call this, I guess, so I first I go west, then I go, southeast, and then I go northeast. In three steps, I'll come back to the same layer. That's that's possible to occur without breaking macroscopically C3 symmetry. But again, this wave vector is not observed in the experiments. And so we'd expect to see bulk rotation symmetry breaking in all these states. And indeed, there's a recent study which studies the this question. What they do is they measure the C-axis resistivity, so the resistivity normal to the hexagonal plane, while applying a magnetic field in the hexagonal plane, and they find that there's a twofold dependence of this resistivity on the field orientation in the plane, and this sets in, sort of gradually, but at a temperature that's rather close to the ordering temperature. So this seems they call this nematicity. Of course, this is very interesting for people who are studying superconductivity because nematicity is often an indication of a two-component order parameter in an unconventional superconductor. But here we can see that actually this nematicity can arise just from the bulk three-dimensional CDW order, and we should be cautious about relating it to superconductivity at all. So what remains, and still puzzling and very interesting, are these anomalous Hall effect experiments, which would seem to point towards something more exotic. What could be going on here? I can only speculate. There are three sort of simple guesses one could make. One is it's an extraneous effect. I prefer not that. So let's think about more interesting possibilities. It's possible that although the primary ordering is real charge density wave at the CDW transition temperature, at some lower second transition temperature, time reversal breaking order appears. Another possibility is that time reversal breaking is somehow just induced by an applied field. This will be the last main thing I talk about. I'll conclude after this slide. If you recall from the RG treatment, actually, in these regions, we found that the real and imaginary charge density waves are both competing instabilities. They can be quite close in energy. And it's conceivable in that case that if they're close in energy and zero magnetic field, an applied magnetic field would actually drive the system into the topological imaginary charge density wave. And the reason is very simple. As I showed you before, in the imaginary charge density wave, the electrons acquire orbital magnetic moments. And those moments are, they're not small, they're a substantial fraction of a Bohr magneton for the important block states that are the ones that are actually involved in the charge density wave. You can write a very simple energetic model for this. If the energy difference between the imaginary and real charge density waves is small, that's parameterized by this parameter lambda, then it only requires a relatively small magnetic field to get the order parameter to rotate from a real charge density wave to an imaginary one. So I'd like to just conclude now, and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Leon. Actually, there is a question from Chandra. So Chandra, do you want to ask a question? You can unmute yourself and ask a question.
Thank you, Jan. But are there any Faraday and Kerr effect experiments, Leon?
Not that I'm aware of, not at this point. Yeah. Would love to see it. Yes.
I had another question. You mentioned that there is integral orbital moment if there is this if there are orbital currents, M point orbital currents in your talk. Can you explain that?
I don't know what you meant by integral orbital moment, but
there's movement of order one or order one or off one.
Okay. The statement is this, okay? If you want the modern theory of orbital magnetization, for band electrons, we can define a magnetic moment for every block state. For a single electron, its magnetic moment, if that momenta is in a range of energy within that's smaller than the gap of the charge density wave, its magnetic moment is order one. It's a, like you can see here, about a half a Bohr magneton. That does not mean that the local moment is order one.
I understand. Yeah. Is it a churn moment for a full band? Is that what you're talking about?
So it's a separate question what the total Berry curvature is. So the orbital moment is very closely related to the Berry curvature, as you know. Indeed. So this is somewhat of a detail. So if you consider the very ideal model, which is perfectly nested, then the imaginary charge density wave will open a full gap and indeed create a churn band with an integer churn number. That's, I think, not generic. Generic situation, the Van Hoff singularity exists and the local orbital moment exists, which orbital moment's not quantized. But the Berry curvature is quantized if you have a full gap. But generically, you actually don't have a full gap for several reasons, the lack of perfect nesting and also that there are other bands in the system. But one would expect a rather large anomalous Hall effect as a consequence of this. So that's the connection to the anomalous Hall measurements. Yeah, thanks for the question.
Okay, so... any other question from the audience? What about the electron-phonon interaction? So electron-phonon interaction that's
right
favors the CDW? Or?
Yeah, I should have mentioned this, I guess. I'm not sure if I have a slide on it, probably don't, but so we can kind of see from this picture. So this first study by Chubakov and collaborators, they assumed purely repulsive interactions, and one actually this favors the superconducting and spin density wave instabilities, not charge density wave. So to get into these other regimes, and these are also generic regimes, if I kind of at random select interactions between these pockets, I can fall into these regimes. But they require some component of interaction, of attractive interaction. What we think is this is probably generated by electron phonon coupling. So mm-hmm. One can ask, you know, which phonons would be most involved in these processes, and they're the ones that can couple to these saddle point electrons are optical phonons that are either at the gamma point or at the M points themselves. And the endpoint phonons, so Mengxing did a nice calculation of those endpoint phonons and their EREPs and how they can couple to the EREPs of these saddle points in the real system. And one can see that they renormalize the interactions, what we'd call G1 and G3. Mm-hmm. So we think that's probably necessary in order to actually drive the charge density forward.
Nice.
Yeah. And there are actually some evidences, you know, you can also look at how do the phonons spectra change as you vary the system through TC. There is something visible in that.
Okay. So,
I have a quick question, Leon. It looked like in the early slides when you showed some thermodynamics for and resistivity for the transition, it looked fairly nicely continuous transition. Is it that the coefficient of this cubic term is small or?
That's an involved subject. So I think resistivity is often a little bit deceptive in it's not the best probe for looking for the order of a thermodynamic transition. So there are much better probes now. So there's some very nice optical experiments and NMR experiments, I think, that pretty clearly show you that the transition is first order.
I see.
That said, I don't know that the explanation of just the cubic term in the Landau theory is actually a good one. If you're really interested in this stuff, you know, you and I both have this history of wasting too much time on critical phenomena based on our youth, So, you know, it turns out if you study the single layer problem of this 3Q charge density wave, in a two-dimensional system, that can actually be a continuous transition, because it's described by a four-state POTS model, and that has a continuous criticality. And three-dimensional, you know, it's an involved subject, okay? But the answer, as far as experiments go, seems to be that the transition is first order.
I see. Okay.
So certainly, but specifically, it looked like that.
Yes. Yeah. Again, you know, specific heat, that particular one looked like that. I picked that one because this is some of the nicest data. If you look, these are early days. Okay. So I think the NMR is some of the best one. Now that's very, very clear, I think.
Okay, thanks. That's really nice.
Okay, so any other questions from the audience? All right, so
that's it.
If there's no further questions, I'd like to thank Leon again for a great talk, as usual. So.